It's VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Russian police detained Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny at passport control after he flew home to Russia on Sunday, his lawyer and the prison service said. It was the first time Navalny has been back home since he was poisoned last summer with a Soviet nerve agent. His plane was diverted to another Moscow airport at the last minute in an apparent effort by authorities to thwart journalists and supporters from greeting him. Navalny was detained when he showed his passport to border guards before formally entering Russia. Witnesses told Reuters his wife, his spokeswoman, and his lawyer were allowed to enter Russia. It was not immediately clear why he had been detained, but the Russian capital's prison service had said beforehand it would do everything to arrest him once he returned, accusing him of flouting the terms of a suspended prison sentence for embezzlement. It's a 2014 case that Navalny says was trumped up. Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine's party said Sunday that it was preparing to challenge President Yoweri Museveni's election victory and condemned what it called the house arrest of Wine and his wife. A spokesman for Wine's National Unity Party, or NUP, said they had evidence of ballot stuffing and other forms of malpractice and planned to use it to challenge the election. On Saturday, the Electoral Commission declared Museveni the winner of Thursday's vote, with final counts showing the president won 59% of votes to Wine's 35%. Museveni is 76 years old, and he's one of Africa's longest-serving leaders. He's been in power since 1986. After he was declared winner, he said that the election may turn out to be the most cheating-free in Uganda's history, and he added that his government would deal decisively with anyone who disrupted the peace. This is VOA News. At least two crew members died after a cargo ship sank in bad weather in the Black Sea off Turkey on Sunday, local officials said. Five seamen from among the 13 on board the bulk carrier Arvin have been rescued. An operation is continuing to find the others, said the governor of northern Turkey's Bartın province. A Ukrainian foreign ministry spokesman confirmed to AFP that the ship was owned by a Ukrainian firm. The vessel was headed for Bulgaria from Georgia when it sank in bad weather. Powerful gusts of winds and snow flurries were reported Sunday in the area where the ship sank. And here are some of the top stories related to the global coronavirus pandemic. Brazil's Anvisa health regulator gave emergency approval Sunday for its first two coronavirus vaccines as the country gears up to roll out a mass inoculation campaign amid a devastating second epidemic wave. It authorized AstraZeneca and Oxford University's CoviShield shot, as well as China's CoronaVac, for use in the country where the COVID-19 death toll now exceeds 209,000. Britain's government hopes to ease some lockdown restrictions in March as it presses ahead with Europe's fastest rollout of COVID-19 vaccines. Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said on Sunday, the country, which also has Europe's highest COVID-19 death toll, has been under national lockdown since January 5th, with schools closed for most pupils, non-essential businesses shut, and people ordered to work from home where possible. India's COVID-19 vaccination drive hit a bump on the first day due to glitches in an app that is being used to coordinate the campaign, according to several officials involved in the immunization program. Prime Minister Narendra Modi launched what his government has described as the world's largest vaccination program on Saturday to rein in the pandemic in India, which has reported the second highest number of cases after the United States. Worry simmered in mainland China about a potential fresh wave of coronavirus cases ahead of the Lunar New Year next month, as authorities on Sunday reported 109 new COVID-19 cases, most of them in the province surrounding Beijing. Though the January 16th tally of new cases was less than the previous days of 130, China has in the past week seen the number of daily cases jump to an over 10-month high. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this annual edition of the program, U.S. foreign and national security priorities and challenges for the incoming Biden administration in 2021. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. At the beginning of each year, we bring you the show from the campus of Georgetown University. But this year, the coronavirus pandemic precludes us from using this beautiful venue, so we bring our scholars to you via Microsoft Teams. A unique set of circumstances sets the stage for 2021 from both a domestic and foreign policy perspective. The VOA newsroom writes that the U.S. House of Representatives impeached President Donald Trump on January 13, declaring he incited insurrection when he implored thousands of his supporters to march to the Capitol to try to overturn his reelection loss, prompting a mob demonstration that turned into deadly mayhem. The final vote tally was 232 to 197. 10 Republicans, including Congresswoman Liz Cheney, chair of the Republican Conference, the third highest position in the House leadership, joined all Democrats in approving the measure. President Trump now has the singular distinction of being the first president in the country's 245-year history to be impeached twice. In a video released soon after the historic vote, President Trump made no mention of the impeachment, but condemned the assault on the U.S. Capitol and pleaded for calm. However, critics say that without disavowing his false statements about widespread election fraud and without affirming that President-elect Joe Biden is the legitimate president of the United States, Mr. Trump's words are insufficient to avert more violence. On this edition of the program, we will talk with our Georgetown professors about the impact the impeachment and subsequent trial in the Senate may have on President-elect Biden's ability to advance his legislative agenda. The good news for Mr. Biden is that Democrats control both the House of Representatives and the Senate, even if by slim margins, which will facilitate the confirmation of his cabinet-level nominees and desire to accelerate COVID vaccine rollout and distribution and pass more COVID relief legislation for individuals and states. How will the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol by domestic rioters, seen as an act of insurrection, affect the U.S. ability to promote democracy overseas, a hallmark of U.S. foreign policy for decades? As President-elect Joe Biden has said, we will have to walk and chew gum at the same time, for his foreign and national security policy team will have to repair and restore alliances, investigate and hold the Russian government accountable for its alleged hacking of at least 250 federal agencies and businesses, and prevent Iran from building up its nuclear capability, among other critical challenges. For more, we welcome our distinguished experts. Anthony Clark Arend is professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Previously, he served as director of the Master of Science in Foreign Service program at Georgetown. And Mark Lagon, he is a distinguished senior scholar in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, and he is also chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. A former ambassador, Mark previously served as president of Freedom House. And as I said, both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Happy to be here.
Well, Tony, let me begin with you, Professor Arend. What is your reaction to the vote to impeach President Trump for inciting insurrection? And also the fear, you know, that more domestic violence may be yet to come, and how you think this will impact President-elect Biden's first days in office?
On the one hand, it's not surprising, because this has been the Trump administration inciting individuals in particular ways. He has been claiming that the election was not properly undertaken, that it was a fraud, and that's all false. But he's been doing that. He's been building up his base. He's been building up individuals to say if he somehow lost the election, it would only be in a fraudulent way. So he'd whipped up the base. He hadn't discouraged violence in places like Charlottesville and elsewhere in the country. So on the one hand, it's not surprising. But on the other hand, it's shocking. We pride ourselves in this country in the peaceful transition of power. This year, we did not have that. So think of that for a second. We did not have the peaceful transition of power in the United States. And that is shocking. Our allies and our non-allies look at this and say, this is not the United States we recognize. Our allies are saddened and hoping we can move beyond this. Our non-allies, whether it be Russia or China or other states in the world, Iran, North Korea, look at it and say, ah, just another example of a failed concept of democracy.
So over to you, Mark Lagon. As Tony said, it is shocking because we're not seeing that peaceful transition of power. And locally, we're feeling it here in Washington, D.C. It's like an armed camp. And on Inauguration Day, January 20, when many people flocked to the mall, the long park that is just before the Capitol, that is going to be closed down. So again, your reaction and the impact this is having on our adversaries and allies.
It is jarring, having worked in the building that was under siege, and yet it is very consistent with a pattern over time that President Trump has denigrated democratic norms. He's encouraged violence against journalists. He said that he paid the legal fees of those who used violent means. He was really encouraging these demonstrators to try and overturn the process. It is finally a point in which those in the Republican Party who were following his influence or explaining to themselves that there were certain elements of his governance that had attracted them, like free market economic growth, it's a reckoning time for them. But as my dear friend Tony says, it's the world watching. And this is far more than the very disturbing Trump criticisms of our democratic alliances or his cozy relationship with, you know, the Saudi leaders after a horrendous murder of a journalist. This strikes at the heart of democratic norms. The contrast with President Biden, just as an objective matter, is striking. Biden is preparing a team of people who worked together closely and that he knows very well, professionals, to come in. He intends to begin with not only addressing the COVID-19 problem, but convening a summit of the democracies. And he said this long before the attack on the Capitol. So you should expect a change. The world will have the United States back in dialogue, although the world and we in the United States should be worried about polarization that persists.
Back to you, Tony Arendt. President-elect Biden says he hopes the Senate will find a way to balance carrying out both the impeachment proceedings and the other urgent business of the nation as the country deals with the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. How optimistic are you that he will succeed? And aside from accelerating distribution of the vaccine and getting additional COVID relief, what are the biggest foreign policy and national security challenges and priorities his team will confront and need to advance on day one?
It's a very good question. And let me start with sort of the first part of that, and that is whether he will be able to achieve those immediately, given that there's going to be a trial for an impeachment going on. And let me just say, this is uncharted territory. We've never had a person that was impeached twice. And we've never had a circumstance where a president, we had it with Secretary of War Stanton once upon a time, but we've never had a situation where a president who was no longer in office was going to be tried in an impeachment. So it's uncharted territory. They're talking about doing a session in the morning, which deals with more traditional business, and then the trial in the afternoon. But we'll have to see whether that happens. Now, what are the foreign policy challenges confronting the Biden-Harris administration? They are manifold, but let me mention several. First, and my friend and colleague, Ambassador Lagon, intimated this. Biden is going to have to reestablish relations with our allies. He's going to have to assure our allies that we are going to be a good player in the international system, that we're going to be collaborative, that we're going to be cooperative. And so one of the first things I think he's going to do, and he can do this himself on day one, is start reaching out to our allies. So that's the first thing he's going to need to do. Secondly, he's going to need to reestablish our relationships in multilateral institutions, whether it's the United Nations, the World Health Organization, or other organizations, the UN Human Rights Council. He's going to have to reestablish these relationships in multilateral institutions. Linda Thomas Greenfield, our former colleague here at Georgetown, as the U.S. ambassador to the UN, is a really good start and an indication of how he's going to try to bring professionalism there. The other thing he's going to need to do is he's going to need to confront China. He's going to need to confront Russia. He's going to need to address questions relating to Iran, North Korea. He's going to need to reestablish our policy on global climate change, and appointing former Secretary of State John Kerry as the envoy on that is a good sign. And I could go on, but those are just some of the challenges confronting him in his first day in office.
Let me get Mark Lagon to add or subtract to the challenges facing the Biden-Harris administration in the foreign policy and national security realm.
Well, I do think it amounts to governance, multilateral cooperation, and global health. I think reassuring our allies that the United States has a consistent policy to try and repel the role of Russia, dealing with the geostrategic rise of China and its influence all over Africa and all over the world, as the United States should offer an alternative governance model, but recent events have made that more difficult. Multilateral institutions that Tony mentions are absolutely right, but in particular, the multilateral accord on climate in Paris, the JCPOA on Iran's denuclearization, and the WHO are things, along with the UN Human Rights Council, the United States needs to reenter. I would emphasize health. Obviously, COVID-19 has engulfed the United States, and the Trump administration has not dealt with it effectively. But the United States' role to play in partnership with others, it needs to re-enter the World Health Organization, leverage the strength of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria on this other pandemic, and work not in a unilateral fashion on vaccines and the necessary strengthening of health systems to go along with it, but in concert with others.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Georgetown University professors Anthony Clark Arendt, we call him Tony, professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University, and Ambassador Mark Lagon, chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And because of the coronavirus pandemic, we are broadcasting via Microsoft Teams rather than coming to you from the campus of Georgetown University in Washington. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our loyal listeners and Facebook fans, Filali Badr from Casablanca, Morocco. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about the national security and foreign policy challenges. So back to you, Tony Arendt. You mentioned many of the appointees, the nominees that President-elect Biden hopes to get confirmed in the Senate, that is the nominees for his foreign and national security team, among whom Anthony Blinken, who will be Secretary of State, Avril Haines will be Director of National Intelligence. You mentioned Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield for U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. And then here's an interesting one. He appointed longtime diplomat William Burns for CIA Director. Again, assuming they are confirmed by the Senate, what is your assessment of these individuals, their credibility, and the ability to garner respect overseas?
Well, it's a great team. It's a great team of professionals who have experience in the field. And I think that sends a mighty signal to everybody out there, again, our allies and our non-allies, that we're bringing in professionals. That's kind of the first message. Secondly, and Ambassador Lagon mentioned this, for the most part, these are individuals well known to President-elect Biden. That means he's interacted with them. He's been working with them for a number of years, and so he has confidence in them. And I think that way you can hit the ground running. One note, you mentioned Bill Burns as director of the CIA. I didn't see that coming. There were all these people that were being speculated, Sue Gordon, Mike Morrell, a variety of other people, David Cohen, all these individuals. And out of the blue came Bill Burns. And I thought, well, that's strange. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what Biden is doing there is bringing in someone who's a well-respected foreign policy expert, who's known in the community and can come in as an honest broker and help rebuild the morale at the Central Intelligence Agency. It reminded me, actually, of Leon Panetta being brought in as director of the CIA, somebody who didn't have direct intelligence experience, but the Central Intelligence Agency thrived under Panetta. He also did an amazing job as Secretary of Defense. So something I didn't anticipate, but it shows a little bit of Biden's creativity. While he's going with tried and true people, he's trying to use them in interesting and perhaps unexpected ways. Samantha Power, for example, going to head the U.S. Agency for International Development. She had been ambassador to the UN and obviously had to deal with development issues, but now she's being brought into a slightly different capacity. Again, someone that Biden would know well, but being able to use her creative talents in a different way in the new administration.
Ambassador Lagon, what's your take on the team? As analysts have said and Tony mentioned, President-elect Biden chose seasoned experts he knows and trusts. They can hit the ground running. And that is important given so much on his plate. What would you add, especially William Burns, former ambassador to Jordan and Russia, now heading up the Central Intelligence Agency? What does that say?
You know, you have people who are savvy, experienced, and who have worked together. And he's been inventive, you know, in putting Burns in a place that he hasn't worked before. But then those who have worked in other places with Burns as a leading specialist on the Middle East and on Russia will have a relationship. Tony Blinken, who is a masterful, understated but strong figure coming in as Secretary of State, you know, he knows Burns very well. And so there are established relationships. I want to say that Linda Thomas-Greenfield is a perfect choice. There's a sign that is to be shown to professional Foreign Service officers that one of their own would be in a senior role. My own experience shows that she's been deft with working with me when I was a congressional staffer in the Senate on UN reform issues, working with me when I was a political appointee, and she worked on Africa on issues of human trafficking. She understands how to work with others in a time where working with those abroad will be hard as the United States tries to reintroduce itself to cooperation with the world and with other players in the U.S. political system.
Turning back to you, Tony Arendt, many analysts are saying that above all, in order to tackle our foreign policy challenges, we really need, that is, the United States needs to fix American democracy at a deeper level, restore, for example, the State Department, which has been hollowed out, many analysts say, restore credibility to our intelligence community who have felt under attack by President Trump. What do you say to that?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think there has been a politicization and in some cases a weaponization of many federal agencies. Certainly, the State Department has undergone a tremendous demoralization, both under Tillerson and under Pompeo. And that needs to be reestablished. And as Mark said, bringing Linda Thomas-Greenfield to the UN is a good message to Foreign Service officers and professionals out there. I also think that the intelligence agencies have been under great strain, especially with some of the leadership or lack thereof at the DNI level. Another branch that I would throw in here, and although it's not completely connected to foreign policy, but I think it does have an impact on foreign policy, is the Justice Department. We have seen a weaponization of the Justice Department, and that's going to need to be something that's going to be addressed. So I see these seasoned people coming in, trying to do that and build up these agencies so we can signal that to our allies and to our non-allies that we are trying to shore up these important pillars of the American governance system.
Ambassador Lagon, go ahead and comment on that. And I wanted to ask you also to touch upon how important that is for foreign policy, because to combat the malign influence of China, for example, or Russia to undermine democracy, we do have to shore up, analysts say, these democratic institutions and rebuild them, lest they say, oh, look at, you know, the United States is, you know, under siege by its own people. How can they promote, you know, democratic values abroad, et cetera?
Well, the United States needs to not only reassure the world about its own democratic system, because to be a proponent of democracy and human rights around the world, we need to be an exemplar, and we haven't been. But also just the sheer efficacy of the U.S. political system, because there does seem to be a breakdown, or in the case of some Trump policies, the effort to willfully break down government capacity. Let's take an example of something that President Biden has to take on based on the bulk of my current work. Global health. We have a COVID-19 crisis in the United States. It's resurging in Europe. A second wave of COVID-19 is hitting Africa. It's even more deadly because there are mutating forms that have arisen in the UK and South Africa. The United States has taken some steps to give funding to vaccines and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, but it needs to do more on a broader front of health systems, testing, and therapy. If you don't have testing and therapy, those mutations will continue to spin out in a health security crisis. The United States under Trump had pulled out of the World Health Organization. It needs to re-enter. The Trump administration before the COVID-19 pandemic had eliminated its own national security team on health security that the Obama administration has created. The very same mid-level staffer for global health security has now been appointed to be the senior level person at the National Security Council, Beth Cameron. Institutionally and in terms of efficacy, the Biden administration plans to, and I suspect will, show efficacy on this one issue where we have to work with the world and with developing countries, because global health security is intermingled. American people's global health security is intimately tied to those around the world.
As we close, Tony Arend, despite criticism of President Trump's foreign policy, some say there are some positive aspects. What do you think could stay in place? Some point to the so-called Abraham Accords that have seen the normalization between Israel and several Arab Gulf states.
Let me say one thing that I think is good, and it connects to what Mark just said. I actually think the so-called warp speed way in which the vaccine was developed, that was good. I'm inclined to think the Abrahamic Accords and being able to reestablish relations between Israel and some of the other states in the region is a good thing, and I don't see that changing. But at the highest policy level, I think the Trump administration took a position fundamentally different than anything it has had since the Second World War. This has shattered our ally relations, encouraged and empowered some of our adversaries. And there's going to be a heavy lift to bring back the idea that the United States is going to be a collaborative leader again. Even though Biden is a fundamentally different person in foreign policy, our allies are going to be saying to themselves, how can we rest assured that the United States has truly turned the corner and is going back to be the leader, the collaborative leader that it has been before? And that's going to take a lot of reassuring from the Biden administration, and perhaps trust will only ultimately be reestablished after the Biden administration, if the United States can continue on a normal collaborative foreign policy.
Will you get the last word, Ambassador Lagon?
I don't agree entirely with my dear friend Tony about the warp speed vaccine operation. It's a good thing, but we need to think about a collaborative approach between countries that will promote equitable access to poor and marginalized people in the United States and abroad. Yeah, great free market approach to get a quick development of the vaccine, but thinking about everyone getting access around the world is important. The continuities, I think Trump's more bombastic way of attacking multilateral institutions will be dialed back to a more traditional U.S. voice for reforming and making more dynamic institutions. The World Health Organization shouldn't be left, but it does need to be less beholden to businesses and some of its member states like China. And on China, I would say this was the distinctive part of the Trump policy. I think there'll be a continued focus on China as a competitive geostrategic and governance model. And I think we should expect from the Biden administration a more subtle but clear effort to counter China's role in the world for the good of the economies and human rights of people.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on our annual Foreign Policy Look Ahead. I'd like to thank my guests, Anthony Tony Arend, he's professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University, and Mark Lagon, a Georgetown University scholar and chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Gentlemen, thanks for a terrific conversation. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dan Friedel brings us the Education Report. He tells about the sound of a foreign word that has caused debate on a U.S. campus. I will return with this week's words and their stories. Today I talk about success, but only one that is very short-lived. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is the Education Report.
Last August, the University of Southern California, known as USC, became involved in a dispute over language that appeared widely in U.S. and Chinese news stories. It started with a white communications professor talking about small words or sounds that people use while speaking to signal pauses. Because of the coronavirus health crisis, Gregory Patton was teaching the class online in a video conference. This fact may have added to the problem. Patton advised his business school students that they should keep the pauses, but should avoid these filler sounds. And are examples of these sounds in English. In the Mandarin Chinese language, Patton said, the word people often use to fill space between thoughts is that. The word is pronounced nega, which sounds like an English word that is offensive to black people. It is known as the N-word and is used to make black people feel less than human. Many students were surprised to hear the sound come from a professor. Some black students were upset and sent a letter to the school expressing their displeasure. They said the professor should have warned them that he was about to say a word that sounded like a bad word in English. Patton, however, said he had used the example in classes before without complaint, so he did not think about warning students. Tom Bartlett wrote a story about the incident for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He said the complaints led to Patton being removed from the class for the rest of the term. Patton, however, was not dismissed by the school. He is still teaching at the university today. Bartlett said one of the main issues to come out of the incident was Patton's desire to protect his reputation. He wanted to be sure the school would support him.
He felt as if his reputation had been harmed by the fact that this became public and the fact that he was being accused by some students of using a racist term.
Bartlett said a group of Chinese students wrote a letter supporting Patton.
And they were bothered by the idea that a common word in Mandarin would be seen as by others as, you know, potentially racist, even though, you know, it was correctly pronounced by the professor. It became a big story in China, in some ways kind of a bigger story even than it was in the United States.
Since the class was online, it was recorded. When people saw the video of the class, they were not sure why the professor's class became a problem. Guilherme Guerrero is a journalism student at USC. He wrote about the story for the Annenberg School of Journalism's website. Guerrero is originally from Brazil, and English is his second language. He said, "It is important to remember that the story came after months of racial justice protests in the United States."
It came out of the Black Lives Matter protests and all that. This story happened around August, like early, mid-August. And the protests have been going on, you know, June, July, et cetera, et cetera. So it came in the wake of that.
Guerrero said, "The country was at a very critical point, a very delicate point, because of the summer of protests." Bartlett was one of the first reporters to speak with Patton after the incident. He said the professor was worried that he might not be able to continue teaching students in the business school at USC. He apologized to students who were offended. Patton also said he would change his class so he would not use a sound that might make future students uncomfortable. Some commentators thought the reaction by the students was extreme. Newspapers around the U.S., from Los Angeles to New York City, wrote about it. The incident even became part of a late-night talk show. Ronnie Cheng is a comedian who appears on the Comedy Central program, The Daily Show. He speaks Mandarin. In September, he spoke with the host of the program, Trevor Noah. Part of the show was called, "Did That USC Professor Actually Say the N-Word?" In the segment, the two comedians seemed to consider the objection by the students hard to understand and acted like they were upset with each other. Noah, who is Black and was born in South Africa, even proposed that the Mandarin language, which has been spoken for thousands of years, should not have the word. After an investigation, the university found that Patton had not meant to offend anyone and did not break any rules. Patton told Bartlett, the writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, that he did not think the story would have turned out the same way if students had been taking the class in person. Patton said he would have heard immediately from concerned students during the class instead of after he had completed the video class for the day. Bartlett said he would have been able to see the reaction of certain students and notice that they were uncomfortable and perhaps followed up with them. They would have had an opportunity after the class, perhaps, to come up and talk to him. Bartlett added that when communicating by video, it's harder in a Zoom environment to read the room, to, you know, be able to sort of sense what people are, how people are reacting. While some may see the student group's reaction as extreme, both Bartlett and Guerrero said there was value in USC's efforts. Guerrero said the school has learned about being more careful with language. "There are some grievances of the community with the university," he said, adding that USC has made efforts to answer student demands. "They are still changing things. They're still doing work. They created certain offices," he noted. Bartlett said the story from USC fits into a higher education discussion about whether professors and students should have the freedom to discuss difficult issues in their classes.
There's a tension often between wanting to listen and take seriously the concerns of students, and then at the same time say, you know, there may be things that are mentioned in the classroom that may challenge what you believe, may seem to be offensive, may bring up ideas that are that might make you uncomfortable.
He added that he thought at the center of this case involving USC's patent was just a misunderstanding, really, that got elevated to something else. Bartlett said, there are cases where universities need to consider what they teach, but this does not seem to be one of them.
In other cases, there are, you know, some real substantive disagreements about what's appropriate and what's what is going to potentially upset certain students and sort of cross a line, and what is just a normal part of the education process. And I think that's an ongoing discussion.
I'm Dan Friedel.
Words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we take a closer look at common words and expressions in the English language. Today, we will talk about how to describe something that shows promise of being great, but then turns out to be not so great. We can call this a flash in the pan. First, let's look at the words in this expression. A flash is a sudden burst of light or fire. Here 1 second and gone the next. And a pan is a kind of container, usually used for cooking. But it has other meanings too. We will talk about that later. Sometimes we use the expression flash in the pan for things that seem to be going well. There is hope. But then, in the blink of an eye, things turn bad. In other words, things go from good to bad very quickly. An artist or entertainer could be described as a flash in the pan if their success happens quickly but does not last long. If a singer is a flash in the pan, we could also call him or her a one-hit wonder. This expression describes an artist who has only one popular or hit song and then disappears from the spotlight. Here is another example of how to use flash in the pan.
I thought that my new boss was going to be here for a long time, but she was just a flash in the pan. Here today, gone tomorrow.
Word experts say flash in the pan probably comes from an old kind of firearm called a musket. These weapons were used during the 16th to 17th century. But to understand the origin of this expression, we have to understand how a musket fired. Experts on the website Revolutionary War Journal explain that firing a musket was complex. It took about 10 steps to fire these guns. So the firing of a musket gun is very much a chain reaction. One action leads to another, and another, and another. The muskets had a place for the gunpowder, called a pan. When you pulled the trigger, a piece of flint would hit a piece of steel called a frizzen. This would cause sparks to fly into the pan, also called a flash pan. This would light the gunpowder, which would then light the main charge. This would finally fire the gun. Sometimes, other times, things went wrong in this chain reaction. For example, sometimes the charge in the pan would light, but would fail to light the main charge. The result? The gun would not fire. When this misfire happened, people called it a flash in the pan. And misfires were common. Through time, the expression flash in the pan soon became used to describe other things. But not VOA Learning English. It has been around for many years, so it is not a flash in the pan. And we plan to be around for many more years to come. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson and American involvement in World War I.
'18 was the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. But World War I did not end quickly or easily. The German army made a final effort to defeat the Allies. The United States had entered the conflict, and Germany wanted a victory before large numbers of American troops could get to Europe. Germany's effort became easier after it signed a peace treaty with the new Bolshevik government in Russia. The treaty made it possible for Germany to use all its forces against the Allies on its western border. In the end, however, Germany's plan failed. Allied troops pushed back the German attack in a series of bloody battles. The addition of American soldiers greatly increased Allied strength.
The leader of American forces in Europe was General John J. Pershing. General Pershing used a weapon new to the world of war, air power. Airplanes were used first, simply as eyes in the sky. They discovered enemy positions so ground artillery could fire at them. Then they were used as fighter planes. They carried guns to shoot down other planes. Finally, planes were built big enough to carry bombs. General Pershing also used another new weapon of war, tanks. He put these inventions together for his battle plan against Germany.
Pershing's target was the Argonne Forest. It was a tree-covered area Germany had held since 1914. The forest was protected by barbed wire and by defensive positions built of steel and concrete. It was the strongest part of the German line. It also was the most important part. If Argonne fell, Germany's final lines of defense would fall. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was fierce. Thousands of men died. Sometimes troops got lost because the forest was so thick with trees. But day by day, the Allies pushed the Germans back.
Germany's leaders were losing hope. In September 1918, they met with German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm. The army chief reported that the war was lost. Germany had no choice, he said. It must give back all the territory it had seized and try to negotiate a peace agreement. Other officials told the Kaiser that the situation at home was bad, too. People were starving. Revolutionaries were plotting to overthrow the government. Kaiser Wilhelm agreed it might be best to seek peace now, before Germany was destroyed completely. He asked his foreign secretary to send a secret message to American President Woodrow Wilson. The message would propose immediate negotiations to end the war.
President Wilson received it. He did not tell the other Allied leaders. Instead, he returned a message to Germany. Wilson asked if Germany was willing to accept the peace proposals he had offered many months earlier. Germany's chancellor answered that his government did accept the proposals. However, the events of war ended the secret exchange of messages between Germany and the United States. German submarines had increased attacks on Allied shipping. 2 passenger ships were sunk. 820 persons were killed. Many were women and children. President Wilson was shocked. He told Germany there could be no peace negotiations with such an inhuman enemy.
In late October 1918, Wilson sent a final message to Germany. He wanted a settlement that would make it impossible for Germany to fight again. Germany, Wilson said, must promise to withdraw its forces from all Allied territory. It also must close its weapons factories. Wilson added that the Allies would negotiate only with a government that truly represented the people of Germany, not with military rulers. The new German chancellor was Maximilian, Prince of Baden. Prince Max received President Wilson's message. He succeeded in getting Kaiser Wilhelm to dismiss the man responsible for German military policy. But he failed to get the Kaiser himself to give up power.
Not all Allied leaders supported President Wilson's plan to end World War I. They could not agree on some parts of it. Britain, for example, opposed the part about freedom of the seas. Britain said it would prevent the kind of naval blockade which had been so effective against Germany. France and Italy opposed the part about creating a new international organization. Wilson had called it a League of Nations. To solve these differences, Wilson sent his closest advisor to Europe to meet with Allied leaders. The discussions were long and sometimes bitter. Many of the Allies thought Wilson was being too kind to the defeated enemy. But in the end, they all agreed to accept the plan as a starting point for peace talks.
By this time, in early November, the situation in Germany was growing worse. Communists and socialists were calling for a rebellion. The Navy was ordered to go to sea. Sailors refused and killed some officers. Reports told of rebellion in parts of the German army, too. The nation's leaders had no choice. They would negotiate a peace treaty. On the morning of November 8th, a German delegation went to Allied military headquarters to discuss terms.
The Germans were met by the Supreme Allied Commander, Marshal Ferdinand Foch of France. Foch greeted them coldly, and he did not offer peace terms until they officially asked for a ceasefire. Germany, not the Allies, had to put down its weapons first. The Germans were shocked when they heard the terms. The list was severe. Among other things, Germany must withdraw its forces from all occupied territories. It must give up Alsace-Lorraine, a part of France it had held for almost 50 years. It must give up most of its weapons, including airplanes, submarines, and battleships. And it must turn over large numbers of trucks, railroad engines, and other supplies.
The German delegation said it could not sign such an agreement. Germany, it said, was not surrendering. It was only asking for a ceasefire. The delegation said it could not accept the peace terms without communicating with the government in Berlin. But the German government was falling apart. Kaiser Wilhelm had finally resigned and left the country. A new cabinet had been formed, and a new prime minister had declared a German republic. Yet the situation remained unsettled. Because of this, the German delegation negotiating with the Allies had to decide for itself. After much argument, the men agreed to the Allied terms. They signed the peace treaty. A ceasefire began a few hours later.
News that the shooting had stopped set off wild celebrations throughout the world. People danced in the streets. They cheered the end of the worst war in history. There were celebrations along the battle lines, too. But these were quiet. Soldiers from both sides climbed out of long trenches dug in the ground. They met the men who, a short while earlier, had been their deadly enemy. The bloody European conflict was over. The dispute, however, was not. Another fierce battle was ready to begin. This time, the battle would be among diplomats. The fight over the peace treaty, officially ending World War I, was about to begin.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.